episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinx podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If there's an author you'd like to see on the show, email me at steve@cinelinx.com and I'll do my best to accommodate. Today on the show, we're talking with author J.L. all about her debut novel, Wings of Ebony, a book that has dominated the early part of 2021 in the world of YA fantasy and debuted on the New York Times bestsellers list, a spot it's officially held now for 2 weeks in a row. The first in a duology, Wings of Ebony and her powerful lead character Rue deals with race and racism in both a contemporary Houston and the fictional world of Kazan. At times, a personal accounting of J.L.'s own life, Wings of Ebony is a moving piece of storytelling that looks to tackle head-on weighty issues like colonialism, allyships, and subjugation, all through the lens of a modern-day Black American teenager. The story is not only inspiring, but revels in both form and function, and we talk about what true life experiences help shape this story and how Rue will undoubtedly inspire future generations of would-be warriors. As we discuss some of the book's key elements and themes in detail, we do have some fun. Trying to figure out which team she ships, Julius or Jamal, and many other things. Warning, this is indeed a spoiler discussion, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but after you've read it, please come back and have a listen. Hi everyone, welcome to the show. Another reminder, it's still Black History Month, which means buying, pre-ordering, calling your libraries, demanding more titles from Black authors, rating, reviewing, social media boosts, basically all the ways you support white authors, just do that for Black authors as well. Ideally, it'd be nice if these actions went beyond 1 month, and we should all be supporting stories that affirm the lives of other people every single day of the year. Let's see if we can do that, make 2021 a year of change. The few friends I have know how I feel about this author, more specifically her debut book. She's the recently designated New York Times bestselling author of Wings of Ebony, which is described as a YA fantasy duology about a Black teen demigoddess named Rue, who must rise up against racist deities, poisoning her block with drugs, violence, and crime. It extends a unique perspective on racism, privilege, cultural appropriation, community, and resilience. It definitely does all those things and a whole lot more. She's here today celebrating her 1 millionth interview. Please welcome JL to the show. Hi, Jay.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Obviously, I was exaggerating a bit, but you've done a lot of interviews, I know, because I've seen a lot of them and read a few of them. So do you have any idea how many you've done? You've done a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I've never put a book out in the world before, you know, so you're sort of afraid to turn things down because you're not sure, like, you know, maybe the word of mouth will be really important. So you sort of just kind of sacrifice your sanity to do every single interview that comes your way. But the best part is you get to meet a lot of fun people. And that's been really fun.
For sure. So I'm going to take advantage of this then, because you will refuse me next year. I know it now. And I'm glad I booked this before you were a New York Times bestselling author, because I know I'm getting turned down next time. There's no way.
No, never. Steve is the super fan of Wings of Ebony, so you're good.
It is a real pleasure to talk to you. As you know, I am one of your devotees. All joking aside, you have been a machine with marketing for sure. You know, and you've got other books to write, deadlines. I just really want to thank you for taking time away from your family to chat with me. It's not lost on me that authors have to do that. It is time away from things more important, probably, so I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Of course. Here's the best part about doing this interview, kind of late in the marketing game, is that we can have a spoiler discussion, and I will be tagging, you know, the shit of this, so no one will fall into this by accident. So we are going to have a spoiler discussion about Wings of Ebony.
Okay. So, I haven't had one of these yet.
I wasn't sure. So for anyone hoping to hear answers to the following questions, you are out of luck. What is the book about? What inspired you to write the book? What is your writing process like? What advice do you have for writers? What do you hope readers will get from this story? I will be asking none of those questions, so don't worry. If there are people out there that want to know the answers to those questions, look up any previous interview, I guess, that you've done. Right? I mean, and I have no doubt you love talking about the book all day and all night, but you don't have to admit it. I know it gets kind of boring answering the same
question. No. It's so fun because, like, you create this book, right? And you put it in the world and you hope it's going to resonate and do these things that you wish for it. But it's sort of like your gem baby that you're excited about and you squeal about, and like your closest friends. So it's been fun to put it out in the world. And like, to be honest, one of the most exciting pieces is like talking about the meat of the book, which I have not been able to do yet because we've been keeping everything spoiler free. So I'm really excited to be able to talk to you about the actual story. Like I have literally not done this without someone, with someone other than like my close friends.
It's great. You know, I was watching Namina's great launch event last night for the Gilded Ones, and you know, they're great. And that was done really well. And
yeah, it was, you know, beautiful.
She looked amazing. I loved her dress from Sierra Leone. Just looked amazing. And she answered, I did get a question in and she was able to answer it. And she went on about how great it was. And it always dawns on me. It's like, I'm always trying to make sure I can ask something that's not the normal run of the mill stuff, because yeah, I know it's a grind. And one of the things I wanted to ask you was, you know, you're so open and active on social media all the time. You're so accessible. Yeah, you're so, you've made yourself like very, very accessible. I've seen you cry more times than I've cried myself the last couple of months. Good tears though.
I'm emotional.
Tears. So am I. I'm no, emotional. That's okay. That's no problem.
Yeah.
And it's really great for, I think it's great. I enjoy it. I love, you know, breaking down that fourth wall and stuff. And because you were so open about everything, I mean, like New York Times bestseller, your book selling like gangbusters, so much love from all these reputable and non-reputable places, probably too, somewhere. It has to feel good, right? Tell me it's what we're seeing from you is genuine. Are you, I don't get the sense you're not a genuine, or you're a genuine person.
I think I'm a little too transparent to be honest. Right. I wear my heart on my sleeve. That's sure. Just who I am. It's not coincidental that Rue is a very feeling person and my book is a very sort of emotional read, because I think that that's reflective of like who I am as a person. And so it's like bled into my writing.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I didn't, to be quite transparent, I didn't, you know, when I joined Twitter, and I didn't really know what I was getting into. So I didn't really think very intentionally about, you know, how private, you know, like when I joined Twitter, to be frank, I didn't know it was going to end up like this. Like, I mean, right. Yeah, I hoped, I'm joining Twitter to get engaged in the writing community and to write a book, but never in my wildest dreams did I imagine this. So I hadn't really thought about until more recently, like, okay, well, how transparent do I want to be? You know, I went through a phase of like, do I post pictures of my kids online? Because that makes me feel uncomfortable sometimes, you know, because there are weirdos out there. So I don't know. I just tend to be, and I mean, I think that there are a lot of friends that like, friends from high school and college who I haven't connected with in a long time who saw the news of my book and have been like shouting about it. It's been fun to reconnect with those friends. But, you know, I think one of the most important things that I wanted to do is I just wanted to make sure that like anything that I accomplish or do feels very duplicatable. Like if this is happening in my life, I want fellow writers to understand that I'm not some superhuman person who came on Twitter and has a sort of like magical ability to write, but like, no, like I'm clueless writer, like number one. And I joined the social media app and just like started making, you know, writer friends on the internet, as weird as that sounds, and learning how to write a book. And I just think it's important in terms of like inspiring other people to do the same, to really sort of allow that access. I will say that the more attention and like with my book hitting the New York Times, like all the attention can be a little intrusive, but I've started setting some boundaries. Like I have a thing where if someone messages me, I make a point to respond to every single message personally. Like I, you know, like read it thoroughly, respond with their name. Even when people comment on my things, like if someone's taking the time to acknowledge that my work and I exist, like I don't know, maybe I'm an extreme introvert. I don't know. I want to make sure that I don't think that they're like some sort of invisible number in my follower count. Like I want them to know that I see them. I actually see them. And I will admit that has gotten very difficult to do lately, but I'm trying. And I'm not really sure how to maintain that or where that goes from here. But I do like to be a very present member of the writing community, just to make sure people know that like dreaming is really worth it.
And you have done that, a lot of that. You've done a really great job of that. And some of that's probably because, you know, you have a teaching background for sure. But, you know, there's been a lot of that from the community in general, lifting up the community as a whole and not only, you know, celebrating it, but, you know, you do things like with DVCon, you did that That's Hooky video, which, yes, which was great. So, you know, silly. Right. That was so great. So, I mean, you know, it's paying it forward in just the most best way possible, essentially. Right. And because you are not far removed from it yet anyway.
No, so and
we'll
see. I don't
we'll talk to let's far removed we'll talk to JL it. In 5 years and see where she's at.
Well, that's the thing, like I wanted, you know, Steve, I talked about this, so one of the projects that I'm working on that I'm sure if you researched or followed you've seen is a nonfiction project with a dear friend of mine. The book is mainly about her, but I'm sort of the ghostwriter on the project with I guess more of a co-author, but the book is about her and her journey and her life, and it, you know, there's this idea that, like, it's called The Outsider Advantage, and it's coming out from Penguin Random House. It's basically like Girl Boss for a Modern Generation. And I think one of the facets of that book that just excites me so much is this idea that, you know, becoming out of touch is a real thing. Like, I don't want to, I mean, there's all sorts of parallels here, both to the book and to sort of the writing community. I don't want to forget what it was like being a clueless writer on Twitter when I first joined, and I didn't know anybody, and I was intimidated to comment on someone's post thinking they might think it was intrusive. When I was terrified about querying, when I was scared to enter a pitch contest, like, I don't ever want to forget what that was like, because I think it's holding on to and remembering what that's like that sort of makes me, or at least I think it's going to keep my feet firmly grounded where I want them to be. I want to constantly empathize with the person in that space. And I think that, you know, that's a whole nod to the concept and idea behind my book. Rue is trying to get home. She's not trying to leave. She's trying to go back home. And so I think staying connected is just so important.
Yeah, I mean, that is almost the thrust of the story with Rue, right? Like, she, like, you drew, like, you know, here's, really quickly too, because sometime between the advanced copies and then the final copy, the name was changed from Gazan to Gizan.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Yeah. I just, you know, when the early copies came out, we just didn't want there to be any sort of, we wanted to be very clear that there was no sort of like actual people who had inspired Gazan. It was completely made up and it was just me playing with letters and sounds.
I see.
And we just thought it might've been too close to like Gaza or anything like that. And we didn't want to give offense or make it, like, we wanted to make sure it was clearly made up.
Okay. So yeah. So then back to the point. Yeah. Here's Gazan, this seemingly sybaritic place, like, you know, wonderful technology. It's this sort of, you know, like African futuristic place. They're giving you magic for free. And all Rue wants to do is get back to East Road. Like, she's literally kicking and screaming on some opportunities. So again, you know, putting yourself, you know, life imitating art, art imitating life. Here's you never wanting to forget where you came from. And yeah. I think, you know, and then if we're going to just really, you know, tie this to the book itself, you know, Rue finds, you know, she finds out that she is the daughter of two worlds, and yeah, she in the end finds this a way to balance these two places. So correct me if I'm wrong, is that what you're telling me, are you starting to move, because now one of the things I wanted to ask you, I mean, you've done nothing but sign book deals since this book came out, right? I mean, like, life, you know, I appreciate everything you just said, and I believe you, right? You don't strike me as a dishonest person. And I know, you know, because I think you're like that or you're not, as far as being able to stay grounded, right? And staying close to your roots. And I have a family, I have a sense that your family would never let you stray too far.
Oh no, they smashed
your Houston family, especially. But, you know, but at some point, you know, things are if they're already out of control, you know, you're going to just, it's going to change, right? Your world has already changed and it's going to change even more. And is that, how are you under all this added extra weight and pressure now? Sorry to bring that up if you'd forgotten about it, you know, because it's going to, because, you know, this is going to change, you know, this is going to change you in a lot of ways. And again, I completely appreciate what you just said about staying grounded, but there are some situations, there are some times you get into the publishing industry is a meat grinder. You've got tough decisions to make, and you've got choices you're going to have to make and things you're going to have to do. Maybe you don't want to do. And
You know, to kind of go back to your two worlds question, just to make sure I don't miss that. Mm-hmm. That I think is very much a parallel to my own life. And I went to private school for a while.
Right.
And I was at a very all white privileged school. I was going to school with CEO's kids, richest kids in town. Meanwhile, my mom's car is literally sputtering through the pickup line, occasionally breaking down. Like, I lived and went to school in completely different worlds. In third grade, my nickname was Nigger. Like, this was my elementary school life. And, you know, I wasn't invited to birthday parties because I was that girl. There were a couple of families who would reach out and be really nice. One family in particular agreed to pick me up one weekend because I was going to hang out with my best friend. And she showed up at my house, and I'll never forget, her parents, once they showed up and saw where I lived, they just left. And I didn't get to, like, I never talked to that girl again. And I think a lot of that sort of pain comes out in this story. And I think sort of like figuring out how those influences shaped me in ways that I'm both aware of and not aware of. I mean, it's an ongoing process, but writing this book was definitely very cathartic for that reason. And it just was such a satisfying reminder of like how incredible my community is and how it is my tether and how I love it that way. Like, I wouldn't have it any other way. And so I think that's what a lot of that sort of dual identity stuff. And I think that that's something that's going to be very relatable to Black kids who are forced to leave their communities, be it because their parents put them in a predominantly white school, or maybe it's, you know, maybe they leave and go to college and they end up at a school away from home. And it's like the first time they've left sort of what is familiar and feels safe. And so I think that there's a lot of, hopefully at least, a lot of inspiring pieces of Rue's story to encourage kids who have experiences like that. And then of course there's like the dual identity piece too, which isn't something that I think I personally relate to as much. My mother is biracial, and that was definitely a struggle for her. She was adopted by a Black family, so she never knew her white mother. She did reach out to her once, and her mother was like, "I gave you up for a reason, don't ever contact me again." Because my mother was born in the 60s, and her mother gave birth with a Black man. And apparently that was not okay with this lady. I don't know. I never met the woman. But my point is like my mother sort of struggling with her, just that sense of abandonment definitely like influenced the way I was parented. And I remember my mom pulled me out of that private school in elementary school. She put me in there on a scholarship because she wanted me to have a really strong academic foundation, and it was a really great school. And they offered me a scholarship. I mean, we were poor, we couldn't afford that. My mom's side of the family was fairly poor. And I'll never forget when I was like, "Mom, why are you making me leave this school?" Now, granted, by now I've come home. She knows my nickname at school. She knows like the cycle. I mean, I was seeing a therapist in third grade because of just how sad I was coming home all the time. And then she finally pulled me out and she was just like, "It's a good school, but like, it's not where you need to be." She was like, "You need to be here where you come from." And she put me in the school that was like in my neighborhood, and it was a completely different experience. So anyway, there's a lot of those parallels in there. Sorry, that was heavy. I know that was a lot, but
no,
I
wanted to. No, well, listen, that's, you know, there's one, yeah. And the, you know, one thing I really wanted to jump on there, what you said is, and it's come up a lot in a lot of other, you know, interviews and online panels and stuff that you've done. And I pulled this really great quote, and I'm sorry, apologize to the person. I don't remember where I got it from. Talking about Wings of Emity, and it says it honors the beauty and challenges one finds in the Black community, but also creates an ideal world where Black people literally are gods. And that, you know, struck me as very powerful and very true. And if you don't believe me, just look at the reaction to this book. Yeah. And people are they might be paraphrasing that or something similar to it, but that seems to be the reaction. Like, mm-hmm. This is Wings of Emity is a game changer in that sense. And it's everything to what you just said. And, you know, I grew up poor as well, but white person poor isn't the same as Black person poor. Right. And especially, you know, because there's way more pathways for white people to climb out of it than black people.
Right.
But at the same time, listening to your story, it sounds like your mother, you know, pulling you back away from that situation might have been the best decision she ever made.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was very formative and very shaping and, and definitely has, you know, all of that has certainly shaped sort of the approach to my narrative. And a lot of that stuff is very like subconscious too. Mm-hmm. It's not like when I was creating Rue's World, I was actively thinking about that, but I see how those things sort of bleed into my work and the ways that I've sort of grown through writing the story, just even as a person. Like Rue has done a lot for me. And my, you know, my hope is that she'll do a lot for the world and for kids, but Rue has done a lot for me personally too.
I think there's a lot that of you in that, you know, that part of your life, that story of your life in this book, especially in the sense where we run into things like root magic and ancestral magic and, you know, getting in touch with your people, quote, you know, quote unquote. And that is the part that, because even though she, you know, had her, you know, Houston East Row family, it's this whole other, that only goes, like, you know, I said in my review, that only goes back so far because that was stolen from black people by white people, that history in the US. So to find your, to find your true history, you've got to travel somewhere else. And and it's, you know, it's sort of like reverse, you know, diaspora, right? Like, and Rue had to do that. She didn't realize it at the time, but she had to leave home to find home in a sense.
Yeah, totally.
And that kind of sounds like maybe a little bit what, maybe, I don't know if that, if your mother was that aware of that by making that decision or not, but it sounds like that's sort of what she did.
Yeah, perhaps, definitely. I can definitely see parallels there. You know, my mom read my book after it came out. She had a copy of The Ark and got caught in a rainstorm. And I always tease her about this because she, most of the time she takes the bus to work. And so she was just holding on. She didn't want to leave her book at home, her Ark at home, because she was just so proud. And then she got caught in a downpour, and the Ark looks like literally somebody dunked it in the ocean. And I always tease her. I'm like, okay, mom, I'm giving you another copy. Do not dunk this one in the ocean. And she's like, I'm so sorry. Like, she just feels so bad. Me and my sisters tease her all the time.
I hope she kept, I hope she kept that, that Ark.
Oh, we still have
that. Yeah. Yeah. You have to keep that. You have to keep that one. Yeah.
It's so funny. But no, she finished the published version. And she just was very moved by it and saw a lot of just our childhood and our family. Miss Leola is named after her mother, that adopted her. So there was just there's a lot in there that was very sweet and precious to her, for sure.
That's great. I was just talking to B.B. Alston recently, and you know, the mother character in his Amari story is based on his mother. It's based on his mother, like to very like down to the job she held. And he was just talking about the first time she read it and called him in tears. And it's just like, yeah.
It was, I love BB.
He's such.
I love BB and Amari.
yes. Oh, I'm, yeah. Amari was fantastic. I'm in for life for that series for sure.
Yeah,
and I wish him nothing but the best. He was the nicest guy. Yeah, so listen, you can lie if you want, you can try and flatter me, but you can't tell me you can't tell me that this demographic of your book was 44-year-old white guys in Canada. So
no, it wasn't.
So, and thank you for being honest. So I think, you know, you've talked ad nauseum about, you know, the intended audience, and which is fantastic and bang on. And I think it reaches that audience for sure. But I like that this book works in a lot of ways, and it really does. And I was shocked, not shocked, that's a terrible word, terrible thing to say, but
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean.
Pleasantly surprised.
Right.
I do.
Just like, just, you know, moved to tears, you know, reading this book. You know, when you're, you know, putting this book together with your team and everything, and, you know, short of like a movie deal, you know, what was the overall talk about, you know, how many different people can this book reach? How well can it do? You know, knowing, you know, the subject matter, even just the time of year it came out. I mean, what was, you know, and like, be honest, what was your realistic expectations based on the publishing industry, how fucking racist it is? Like what was the idea here?
So a couple things. One, publishing doesn't really talk about those things on the nose.
Right.
So they don't, you know, they don't really say. They're very good at answering questions in more of a generalized way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, last year was hard. Okay.
Yeah.
Every year being a Black person in America is difficult, but last year was especially difficult, particularly in the summer, with the murder of George Floyd and then watching just the resulting protests and from that, and just the brutality and the macing and the Breonna Taylor. And, you know, it just, it was a lot. And so I didn't know, obviously, when I wrote Wings of Ebony that it was going to come out at such a relevant time when the public was paying so much attention, because these issues are not unique to our community. This is a pervasive problem. And, you know, it was difficult to realize that my words were going to be so relevant. I can't even, it's hard to put into words what that feels like, Steve, because, you know, I write this book to inspire children, to provide a mirror and a window. I didn't write it with a white gaze, but I did write it so that it was, you know, if a white person picks up my book, I have something to tell them through it. But I didn't write it for them. But it's one thing to sort of write the book and hope that it inspires and does good. But it's another thing to sort of put something out that is so reflective of our current pain, like very real, like wounds that are still bleeding, that just won't scab over. It's not sweet. It's bittersweet. You know, and I feel very fortunate to have been able to put this book out. I'm hoping that it is very much a healing balm to people. It's very healing for me to read. I've read it a few times since it's come out. And so I'm hoping that it is that. But at the same time, I'm grieved that it's necessary. I'm grieved that there's a wound for it to speak to, that there's a wound that needs healing. So it's a mixed bag of emotions. I didn't know what to expect. My book is very on the nose about racism. And I didn't know, you know, my publisher told me when they acquired the book that it was going to be a lead title, but I've heard of publishers making promises that they don't keep, you know, like once they sort of sample the book among their buyers, you know, and their accounts, they see how it does, and then they sort of tweak and adjust their plans, or at least that's my understanding. And this is not a very transparent process. You don't get to see, okay, we're cutting this budget, we're doing that. They don't tell you all that. So I found an external publicity firm, and I begged them to take me on. And I was like, hi, this is before my book even sold. I was like, if my publisher does nothing, I want someone to be right there beside me to help me, you know, propel this book and get it into the hands of kids to accomplish what I published it for. Because great books go unnoticed all the time. There are books on shelves that don't get marketing budgets, that don't get pressed, that don't get much publicity, that nobody hears about, and they're just as important. And so I knew that, like, the importance of my book wasn't enough. It wasn't going to be enough. And if I wanted it to reach kids, I needed to rely on what I know. And in true Rue form, you know, she got her crew together at the end of the book. She got her people together. And that is what I did. You know, I reached out to a publicist. This publicist was, she's the co-founder of her publicity firm. And to be really transparent, you know, I was asking her about publicity packages and things like that. And she's like, well, first let's wait and see what your publisher is going to do, you know, because you don't need to pay for something if they're going to do it. And once she actually read the book, she came back and she said, like, as a company, she called me in tears. She's a white woman. She said, I'm going to do everything in my power to get this book into as many children's hands as possible. She was like, our company is coming alongside you and Simon & Schuster to market this book for free.
What was your reaction to that at first? Because you do, like, we know a lot of the horrors that go on, right? A lot of promises are made.
Yes.
And you have, I'm sure you have, you know, a lot of fellow Black author friends who have been told similar things.
Well, so this is an external firm. This is not a publisher. This is an external firm.
Right.
And I had developed a relationship with my publicist, you know, early on. So we've, at this point, we'd known each other for a little over a year. We've been talking and strategizing, you know, making preliminary ideas, and she's always delivered on everything I've asked. But when she called me in tears after reading the book and being very touched by Bree's story and just like how important, she's from the South too, so I think she got the book on another level. And she, she seemed very moved. It seemed genuine, and nothing she's ever shown me has made me question that. I also, though, am not a very suspicious person. Like, I tend to assume the best in people, and I realize it makes me incredibly naive, but it's just who I am, you know? I believed her. And she assembled her team. They put together a marketing plan. And Steve, 90% of the press that I've gotten, they did.
Awesome.
95% of it, they did.
Right.
And it's not because my Simon & Schuster didn't try. Simon & Schuster worked very hard. My publicist worked tirelessly around the clock for me. But, you know, this book had a hard time getting national attention. I don't know, from the time that we tried to release the cover, I don't know why that is. I think the cover is beautiful. But, you know, my publisher tried for a long time to get particular outlets to drop the cover. And this was in the middle of last year. And so for whatever reason, and I never really got an explanation. I don't think my publisher got an explanation either. I mean, the news cycle was very, very busy. There was a lot happening, but I did see them releasing other covers. So it's not like they weren't doing it at all.
Right.
But they did their best, and they couldn't get the cover reveal in some big national outlet. But, you know, it's fine. Like, Rue's an underdog. I'm an underdog. It's just, I'm used to being underestimated, right? So my publisher actually was able to release it in Publishers Weekly, which ended up being phenomenal. And it got beautiful visibility. I think even like more targeted visibility. And so I just feel like every step of the way, you know, I've been surprised at what's worked out. And I credit the story for that. You know, I credit the heart of the book and the heart of Rue that's capturing readers and people who understand why it's important. My publisher did a lot. I mean, I think they did a ton, a lot more than they do for a lot of books, Steve. I was a major book for them. And in terms of marketing and like book boxes and, you know, like they gave me great access to, like, very early on, they gave me access to some of their senior people, department heads. I could email them, ask them questions. They were responsive. So, I mean, I've never done this before, but I felt well taken care of by my publisher in a lot of ways. And that still doesn't guarantee book placement, if it's going to be in Target, if it's going to hit the New York Times. All publishing can do is sort of like, we gather together, we make a plan, we execute the plan, and we hope for the best. Now, I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but I don't have access to those conversations.
Right.
So for what I got, I was very satisfied. And having my external publicist next to me, they work tirelessly. And part of the team is international. So like, when I'm sleeping, my international team is working. And when I'm awake, my local team is working. And I think just the combination of all of that, which again, I don't credit to me, or like, it's really just, it's Rue, it's the story. And I think that anyone who is willing to open the pages of the book and read it through understands why. It's so important. And I think one of the coolest things, this is sort of an aside, is that it's been really fun to watch people react to the book. Mm-hmm. It's one of those stories that seems to be making people want to talk about it. And that means the world to me, because I feel like the more people talk about it, the more they're going to spread it, the more kids they're going to gift it to. And that's what this is about. I can't rely necessarily on like national media or publishing to like project my book into the stratosphere, right? They're only going to do what makes sense business-wise. And I thought they did a great job. But I am going to scream and shout. And my street team is going to scream and shout. And the people who believe in this book, apparently I'm learning, are also going to scream and shout.
There's been a lot of screaming and shouting, for sure. There is a strong message in this book, and like you said, and, you know, it is a book, and I think it does have, I mean, all that stuff that you just said is fantastic, and it really warms my heart and makes me feel great that you had all these people that felt so strongly about making sure this book got out there. But at the end of the day, if the book sucks, I mean, it doesn't really matter, right? So that's right. Great. And then it's right. Put, and it's a poor, and you don't earn out, it's a poor, all of a sudden that team goes away. You know, so yes, the team, but you know, JL, this doesn't work if you didn't write an incredible story with an incredibly powerful message. And I mean, this thing does appeal, I think, to a lot of different, like racists would probably enjoy this book, not the ending, but, but you know, it's so good. You know, the whole thing is great.
There's going to be people who come in there not expecting to be slapped.
And right.
Absolutely. They have a lot to learn.
You know, and part of that message is, you know, there's so much of that, like you said, 2020, it's carried over into this year. It's never going away. It was here before. It'll be here long after us, unfortunately. One of the things I said, I wrote my review, you know, I said, you know, self-determination is a luxury most Black people are not afforded. Because of that, Wings mm-hmm. and Ebony becomes less a cautionary tale, more of a call to action, offering up tangible proof that dignity, yes. placing value on someone just because they're human can destroy the foundations of racism. One of the things I love that you said, feels like forever ago, that this is sort of like your form of protest, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is my activism.
And, you know, one of the things I've talked about this year so far is trying to focus less on the problems, more on solutions. Mm-hmm. I feel like we know the problems, like systematic, structural, you know, lack of jobs and advancement, discrimination, ownership of property, basically white people and white, male, white created systems are the problem. We know that. I think we know that. And not to say we should shut up about, we shouldn't shut up about that. I'm not saying that at all, but it's me just trying to be more constructive in a way. And I look to you, you seem like a solution factory to me, you know,
whether
from your teaching to your, you know, you've done work with high schools now, you've made sure, you know, high schools have gotten this book. By speaking truth to power. I mean, just the message itself is that mm-hmm. you're denying that, but I was, you're
saying. I mean, yeah, I hear you. I don't have all the solutions, but I can't not do anything.
Right.
And I'm going to work tirelessly to make sure that the book gets out there. And I mean, until I burn out,
yeah,
which I hope doesn't happen.
Well, let's speaking of the book, let's talk a little bit about the book. And before I do, though, you know, you're doing this amidst deadlines as well now. And I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't ask you, you know, how are you finding that? Are you challenging? Does that energize you? Does it exhaust you now? Because you're on the tail end of marketing for this book, but you're still doing it. I assume you've got people, you know, with their hand out waiting for, you know, whatever number of drafts or
for the next book. I have three books coming out next year. I mean, one is a nonfiction, which I'm just like the writer, so it's a little different. I'm not marketing that one,
right?
But I have two books coming out next year, my first middle grade and my sequel to Wings. But you know, I like to work. I really do enjoy it. In fact, today I was trying to figure out what to do because I was like, I'm waiting on my next pass of edits from my editor on the sequel to Wings of Ebony, mm-hmm. which should be in my inbox pretty any day now. And then I have edits, my last round of edits on my middle grade, which is coming out next year. And that is due, I think that's coming to my inbox the last week of February. So I was like sitting here and I was going, what do I do today? Like my kids were in school. I was sitting on the couch. And it's funny because I feel like most people would read a book or watch a show, but it's like, I enjoy working so much. And this is probably a problem, but I enjoy working so much. It also doesn't help that we're in a pandemic. If we weren't in a pandemic, I would have gone somewhere and done something. But I pulled out one of my mentees because I mentor a lot of writers. I pulled out one of my mentees' books and started like line edits on her work. So, I mean, you know, I find the time. I enjoy working, which is probably a big part of it. I'm not the best at work-life balance. Like, I can admit that. But it's going fine right now. I would say the hardest time was in January because I had three deadlines before Wings came out. I didn't expect Wings to come out till in the end of February. So when it got moved to January so that it could be the book club pick of the month for Barnes & Noble, I was ecstatic. But it also meant that, like, 10 days before my book released, I had three deadlines. That was very stressful. I couldn't really sleep. I couldn't really eat. I literally grew like 10 gray hairs in 1 week, I think. That was a lot. But, you know, bite-sized pieces, I'm an efficient writer and drafter and reviser. So, you know, I got past it. I scaled the hurdle. You know, and some of this is just like sort of what you do to survive in this industry. And I think that that's a huge problem, because like I can't work at this pace consistently. Like I will burn out, and and that sucks, right? Because I'm trying to do like important work and helpful work and put these books out for children. And I'm also like, you know, this is how I feed my family. This is how I take care of my family. But you know, if the pace isn't, if the pace is going to continue being so breakneck, you know, how long can I hang? I don't know. So
well, we'll and, I, and then, you know, hopefully I that doesn't sort of seep into the quality of the work as well, right? I assume you must be conscious of that now. You know, is this like, you know, affected the affected anything you, you know, with the sequel or anything, any future products? Is it weighed heavily on you enough to where you're like, I don't,
you know, that's the thing about writing. Every book I write, I notice just an improvement in my grasp of the craft. You know, when I look at Wings of Ebony, I know it's a beautiful book and I'm very proud of it, obviously, but like at my writer brain sees all of like, you know, the issues with it and like things I would still change, because you can edit a book to death. Like you can like never be done editing.
Right.
And so I actually think, you know, my sequel to Wings of Ebony in terms of like the writing and sort of the cohesion of the story and the world building, I think it's beautifully done, vastly better than sort of my first iteration of Wings of Ebony. So I'm excited to see. I mean, it's a different book and it's going to be enjoyed in a different way. But I think readers will really enjoy it. So I'm excited.
Good. Well, I, a lot of people are excited. It's it's a year away at least, so we'll have to wait. Wings of Ebony, I'm going to call this the title, this discussion, we're going to call it Ride or Die. One of the great, Rue's got, like you said, her team, and an important member of her team is Britt, her Gazoni friend. There's a great pair, you know, back home she has, you know, her sister Tasha. This Britt is sort of like her sister, but more best friend. But, you know, there's a sort of bring people up to speed. There's a point where Rue finds out her ancestral history, how she's tied literally to the land there, thanks to her father. And she finds out that not only, you know, is she's not only connected in profound ways, but you know, her blood is her ancestral's blood is literally, she's in the ground, in the earth. She finds out she's connected to, you know, Gazan in ways that no one could ever have thought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finding out this truth changes the entire landscape of this area, of this country, right? Of this land, not only, you know, just from a spiritual level, but at every level of government, right?
Absolutely.
You know, like, you know, everything is going to change for all these, for the people of New Gazan who have been there and reap the benefit from it.
Yep.
And one of these people is Britt. And there's a really important and a really great section in this book. And it's one of my favorites, where Rue, you know, tells Britt all of this information.
Bree.
And Bree's reaction isn't maybe what Rue would hope for.
No, it wasn't.
Right. So she immediately clings on to, everything I've worked for my whole life has been a lie. My whole life, everything I've worked for, everything I may be potentially losing everything, everything the Chancellor has promised us is now worthless. Poor woe is me. This is huge. I think this is a huge part of the book.
It's my favorite part of the book.
It's massively important, because I really think it speaks on a contemporary level in a big way. So talk about sort of that idea, where that came from, because there's this thing where, you know, this in real life, again, holding up a mirror, you know, there's all these things that me as a white person benefit from, right?
Yep.
Black culture, black art, whether it, you know, music, film, television, publishing, whatever it is. And when that is threatened in any way, how we react, react as a people says a lot about who we are.
Yeah, totally.
And any cause of discomfort or material change or wealth in our own life, suddenly the claws can come out, can't they?
Yeah.
So talk about, sort of put that scene together for me. Talk about where that came from.
So it's really important for me to, I mean, we can't talk about racism without talking about privilege. And so I knew if this book is going to be about racism, we're going to have a conversation about privilege. And if we're going to have a conversation about privilege, we're going to have to talk about allyship. And Bree was the natural person to accomplish that through. It was very important for Bree to be very likable. I wanted readers to really love her. And I wanted to see that that she truly does love Rue on some level. And Rue loves her. They're very good friends. But it was important for me. And I mean, I know that readers see themselves in characters. So, it wasn't lost on me that white readers might see themselves in Brie. And it was important for me for them to love Brie and see how Brie is a good friend and see how Brie is such a help to Rue and so empathetic to Rue. And yet how Brie benefits from the colonization of this island, how Brie has privilege that she is not aware of, how Brie can make mistakes. And I think that considering the conversations that we've had in the country this past year about privilege and allyship, I've never lived through a time where those conversations had such national attention. I think it's a great way for white readers in particular to engage with a character who they can identify with and love and care about, but then also like sort of gently, if you will, understand where their perspective falls short, where their bias, where their own prejudice, racism creeps in. And I think that's a challenging thing to do in a very sort of direct conversation, especially for someone who isn't interested in engaging with that content. So I thought it was a perfect thing to weave in, in a fantasy book about other characters, because you sort of have that nuanced parallel there. And a lot of times readers are more comfortable engaging with the content that way. I'm really hoping book clubs that, that are diverse with white and black readers and other, other races and ethnicities too, really dig into this, the meat of this, because it's very important to understand, racism isn't just the people who are so blatantly bold about it. It's also the other people who aren't aware. It was important for Brie it was important for Brie to respond in a way that felt real. I didn't want her to just change her mind, because I think what we're seeing now, especially, after last year, is, when you confront someone with this idea that they're privileged, a white person, like you said, how they respond says a lot about kind of where they're at or who they are, but they can respond one of two ways. They're going to either respond and sort of believe you on some level, or they're going to respond in a way that says they think that that's complete bullshit. And I think it was important for Brie to respond in a way that I've seen people respond, in this very sort of real world situation. I decided to parallel her response to the stages of grief. And it was important for her to go through those different stages. So she goes through denial. She goes through bargaining. Yeah.
She goes through quickly, but yeah.
Yes. And yeah. She doesn't quite arrive. And that was important as well for my white readers to understand that allyship is a verb. Mm-hmm. And it is not something that you can perfectly arrive at. There's always going to be dissonance between Rue's experience and Brie's. And I think the important lesson for Brie, and hopefully what readers take away, is that you can want to be an ally. You can think you're an ally, but you can be wrong. And I'm hoping that it really forces people to evaluate their actions and their decisions and the quiet thoughts that they have that they never say out loud, to sort of shake up some of these things, that some of these sort of like cemented ideas that these sort of performative allies do. Because I think it's easy. You remember Haley? I think that was her name. Haley in The Hate U Give, the one who told Star, pretend like the basketball is a piece of fried chicken or something like that. Something just incredibly racist. It's easy for a white person to say, well, I'm not Haley. I would never say that. That's not who I wrote Brie for. Right. I wrote Brie for the people who feel like they see Haley and they think, oh, well, she's definitely not an ally, but I am. I know better than that. That's who I wrote Brie for. Because I don't think that books speak to that person often. I also wanted it, keeping the teacher side of me, in my head, I also wanted to make sure that teachers who are, having discussions in classrooms, teaching kids who have lived through 2020, trying to make sense of the world, have tools to have these conversations. And I think that there are a lot of white, well-meaning teachers who just don't know how to approach these topics. And so I'm hoping that they learn from Rue and are able to take that work on themselves and use it in their classrooms instead of asking the Black people in their lives to do it.
Yeah, and this idea that, you know, you can't earn something that's stolen, right?
Oh, yes. And that's,
I mean, you see it, we see it all day, every day, right? On social media and everything else, people enjoying the fruits of other people's labor is essentially what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
And if you want to get really into it, we're talking about, you know, the sweat on the back of Black people who built this country, you know, and here we all are reaping the benefits of that.
Yep.
And like you said, I'm a very, you know, you put it in a really nice sensitive way there, you know, like, you know, Bree isn't the worst person to walk the earth. She's got to wake up.
Yeah. And that's her work to do. I thought that was that was a very intentional piece where you can sense how stressed out Rue is. And I wanted the reader to understand that, like, I can't tell you how many phone calls I got, Steve, last year from well-meaning white friends asking me to explain what's happening in the world to them. Like,
right.
Rue has her own shit going on. She is dealing with a lot.
Yeah.
That is your job to figure out, not Rue's,
right.
Not mine.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, I talk to so many authors when I talk to, I don't even want to say, like, what can we do? Tell me what we can do. Like, that's for us to figure out. Like, you know what to do. I know what to do to support. We'll just keep it in publishing. I know what to do to support Black authors, right? Like, it's not a secret. It's the same thing you do the other 90% of the time when you're purchasing a book, right? So just adjust the numbers a little bit. You know, a lot of this too is tied to this idea of, you know, ancestral and root, you know, the magic that you've created, this system, you know, and I love when you have this thing where how do you say, is it Asim or Asim?
Asim. I've heard it multiple ways. I say Asim.
Asim, okay. You know, Asim takes her on that, I mean, essentially a pilgrimage to, you know, Yayo Peak, does the cave tour where she finally meets, you know, Bati and she finally meets Black people in Kassan for the first time. And this, and that's when she really finds out her own history, her father's history, her people's history. And she finds out that this magic was stolen by the chancellor a long time ago. He was a neighboring warring tribe and he stole this magic from her people with promises of, you know, a better life, basically, because they were kind of hurting at the time, right? They were
dying out.
Weakening and dying out, and their magic was starting to fade a bit. So the chancellor comes in. He's the charlatan archetype. He comes in promising the world, gives them none of it, of course, but they don't know that at the time. They're desperate people. Again, another contemporary. When you're thirsty, you'll drink almost anything.
When he shows up. The other villages, the other grays on the island with no magic were absolutely parched at the idea of, like, oh my goodness, we could have magic too.
Right.
Because, you know, the brown skinned people on the island have it. So surely we deserve it too. When the chancellor visited Asim's village, they knew he was lying because they knew where their magic came from. They knew he was either a thief or a liar. They played nice in his face because he couldn't, you know, like, they were weakened, but they knew immediately that he was not friendly.
One of the most powerful, like, images and things you talk about in this book is the onyx, you know, that are, you know, physically attached to Rue and other people, that is apparently the source of their magic. And then you completely abandon that. And we find out that, you know, you don't need this at all. Like, her people are telling her, you don't need that. Magic is inside of you. And she finds out from Bati, you know, she sees all these people that are, you know, weaving, casting without these stones. And talk about that idea, because you create this incredible system of magic and you tie it specifically to onyx. And then all of a sudden you just say, you're like, nope, that's not it.
Yeah. I mean, there was intentionality there, right? Like, I love the idea that, white people think that they can hold our power and that they can wield it like us.
Right.
And they can't. And so I thought it was very interesting to play with the magic that was on the hands, like magic wielded through hands. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of imagery there, right? Like the work of Black people's hands. I really liked sort of tying in that metaphorically. And then I think too, you know, it was intentional that I used a Black stone in particular, because it could have been any stone, but I wanted it to be onyx because I wanted, you know, it's so fun to talk about these little things because like I haven't been able to dig into the weeds of this for anybody. It's fun. But I wanted to use a Black stone because I think that there's also, it's sort of a nod to this idea of like, you know something is wrong deep inside when you're being racist, prejudiced, biased, oppressing other people. Somewhere inside, I don't buy this idea that people just are innocently racist. I don't buy that. I don't buy it. Something in you knows, and maybe the depth of that knowledge is not very deep, but something in you knows that something's off. And the stones are Black because and this is not in the book, so it's not like in the canon of this world, so I don't want to be confusing to readers.
Right.
But like, I love this idea that like on some level, the Greys knew, you know, where did this come from? And it's not coincidence that it's a Black stone in their wrist, sort of as a nod to like, you know, this is from Black people. This is not yours. And no, that's not written into the story, but it was intentional that it was a Black stone.
This idea that, you know, the Chancellor presents it as I'm allowing you to have this magic. I'm giving you this magic. And we found out that you don't need to wait to be bound to be magical. Yeah. To be magical. Yeah. You are and God, you know, it's so many hundreds of years we've spent, you know, being told, Black people have been told, we're allowing you here, we're giving you, this is our gift to you, and we find out that no, you're born with it.
Yeah,
like that's incredibly powerful. And yeah. Talk about that. Is that just go to the heart of everything? Sort of what you just said too. I mean, like,
yeah, you know, I mean, it does. It's this idea that like
we're all, anyone can be Rue.
Yes, yes, and I think the beautiful part about the metaphor there is this idea that you look around at the world that we live in, right? The real world that we live in.
Right.
And everything that you see doesn't suggest that the world knows you're powerful and you're magical and you're capable, but you are. And that's, you know, that's the structural parallel there. You know, she lives in this world where on the surface, I mean, it's not coincidental that like when we show up to Kazan and when the reader is first introduced to Kazan, you know, we accept this idea that it's the Grey's magic. Like the reader passively accepts that. They don't even question it because that's so normalized in the real world and in just books, period, right? And so I think it really says something that sort of like when you peel all that back, it's like nothing you see when you look around, just because that's the state of things, is the truth or reflective of the truth. And so I think that that's just a powerful message, hopefully, to kids, and to really too, to like look at their past and look at where they come from and be inspired by that.
And well, the thing about that too is because, you know, what the saying about, you know, history is written by the winners or whatever.
Yep.
And you have that line in this book, which, you know, I remember the first time I read it and it's like, it, you know, gave me goosebumps and all that other stuff. But it's such a, but then you know, you think about it, just all you have to do is think about it for 1 second. You're like, of course, it's the line is, you know, it wouldn't be written. Who expects their history to be erased?
Right.
And right. Like, yeah, right. But that's exactly what fucking happened.
Yep.
Right.
Exactly.
And God, you know, I know you read a lot of books as well. We read so many books where, and this, you know, no offense to anybody at all. If I could write, I would. Trust me, it's my most envious of things. a lot of times people are like, oh, you know, first and third acts are great, second drags in the middle a bit. You hear that a lot, right? From people, just for whatever, whether it's true or not. The second act in this book is fucking killer. And it's all because of that entire section that starts, right? When, you know, Asim grabs her by the hand and says, I know you hate me, but I got to show you something. And not only does it changes the course of everything. So it starts with her grabbing her by the hand and saying, come on, come with me just for a little bit. And then ending, you know, going back to Houston with armed with like lightning bolts, you know, at that point, right?
Yeah. No, yeah.
And then, and you're like ready for this massive epic third act. And then you kill as him. Why would you do that?
And, and that's a hard scene to read, let me tell you.
I'm not a hard cry. I'm just going to say that. But I don't cry just because the wind changes either. But man, did I cry during that scene. So, I mean, I've already spoiled it. It's too late now. but I mean, he does it. You do it in the best way possible. He knows it's a one way ticket.
Yeah.
And yep. He makes the ultimate, I guess, sacrifice for Rue. And I'm getting emotional right now talking about it.
Yeah.
And it's a very hard scene.
He gives her a gift before he dies.
That sort of, you know, that gift you're talking about is he gives her, I guess it's like the gift of, I'm not going to say memory, but just.
He gives her the images in her head that she can have as memories, which I think it.
Right. And then, so then she finally, even though she was already really starting to come around and had come around a lot.
Yeah.
For sure. But then she finally sees him for who he really is. And yeah, she sees memories of him being the father that she always accused him of not being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as he's dying, like it's
so it's sad. Just, yeah, I'm like thinking about it and getting so
I'm
sad.
Getting emotional right now. And it's just like, I remember reading and I was like, fucking Jesus Christ. Like it's already sad enough. And then because that's not the whole scene, right? That's the memory part sort of picks up past the halfway point, I guess, of that little scene. So, All right. Main character, they spend the whole book fighting it, you know, sometimes in just really kind of tongue-in-cheek funny ways too, this whole father trying to reconnect with his teenage daughter, right? Like there's a lot of really great back and forth between the two of them, and she is not a tough nut to crack, and I don't blame her one, and I don't blame her one bit, right? Because as far as she knows, he abandoned her family.
Yeah.
And of course you would react that way to somebody. I would.
So I mean, the very own voices piece of my story, just as a note.
Okay.
I wrote out a lot of my animosity towards my father because he was very absent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how true are we talking here? If you don't mind me asking,
he's still alive.
Well, not no, not that he's dead. I mean, were you able to mend any old wounds or all? That's too personal. Just tell me to shut up. That's fine. You know what? Don't worry about it. Another time.
I will say this. I'm working on getting to a. I will say that writing this book was cathartic. And then on the other side of it, like reading it published, actually, it wasn't until I read it published that I've been evaluating sort of, you know, reaching out. I just feel like it's not my burden to carry. And that's one of the things I loved about Asim is he wanted to do the work to repair their relationship. He didn't want to put that work on Rue. Which I think is really important because it's not Rue's responsibility. She's a kid.
One of the great things too, I like about Asim is there's a little bit of it for sure, but you know, this idea that, you know, skin folk ain't kin folk, right?
Yes.
He gets a little bit of that, but not a lot. And I'm glad you don't sort of go too hard on him because I think Rue really does give him the gears pretty good.
Well, what I'm trying to do there is I'm trying to draw a bridge between just because he's not from where I'm from, like he doesn't get my life,
right.
You know, so like he doesn't feel like family. But you know, there's a lot in this book about family and community. And so what I'm really doing is showing you how sort of the definition of family, at least in our community and Rue's community is not necessarily how other people define it. And so, yes, they're both, you know, Black people, but there was a connection there that was missing and not just like absent. It was something that I think they both longed for. He certainly longed for a connection. And we know that Rue is being stubborn, but like deep down, she wanted that connection too. And so I think the beautiful part about that is that I'm sort of redefining what family means. It's not just who you're related to, but it's also not everyone you're related to, you know? So it just, it's sort of this broader term. And I didn't know that that was necessarily unique to my community, but as I've moved around the country a lot and met people from all different places, I've learned that not everybody sees community and family that way. There's a lot of like blood is thicker than water people. And just from where I come from, that's just not, it's just not how we roll. It's just not.
I think it's really interesting too, how, you know, when we find out from Bhatti and the rest that, you know, a Sim is basically, his mandate was to sort of try and fix things from the inside. So rather than sort of hide out, he chose to stay and, you know, try and affect change, you know, from that side of the fence, basically. And one of the things that I love too is, you know, how his style slowly sort of changes Rue's style a little bit. She's a hard charger at first, right? But then she learns, you know, to be a little more, you know, tactful, I guess is a good way to put it. So now, you know, so in that sense, and in order for her though to like ultimately learn that about herself and him, was killing him seemed to be maybe the only choice you had.
You know, I could have left him alive.
But it's the most effective way, though, right? To get the point across. Well, and I think it needed to be...
His sacrifice. His sacrifice.
Right.
Did I lose you? Sorry.
Nope.
His sacrifice was so important to me because I thought it was his ultimate expression of love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like the running theme of her life was... Or the sort of the running theme of her impression of him was, what did he give up? Like, me and Moms gave up everything. What did he lose? And so, I mean, the only thing that really he had left, like his most valuable asset, if you will. And I mean, he didn't plan to sacrifice himself for her.
Right, right.
But his daughter needed him. Right. And it was like, in that moment, he had to.
If I could like have any spinoff series, it would be him and Rue's mom.
I've wanted to write that so bad.
Even just a scene or two, you know, like you do talk a little bit about it, and there's those moments are so sweet, you know, when he realizes that she held on to the cuff that he left behind. And you know, there is love, profound, deep love there, and you know, yeah, at first you're like, you know, screw this guy, but then you find out, you know, what really went down, and then you find out, you know, the why she was shot, and you know, and it wasn't supposed to be her, and then you're just like, oh my god, JL, what are you doing to me? And it's just like,
oh, wait till you get to the sequel.
No, no. Just wait. Let's okay. So, sequel. I don't want to keep you for too much longer. So, yeah.
I just found out that I hit the New York Times the second week in a row.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations.
I didn't even look. Somebody Sama Tahir just texted me.
I just got a message too. Somebody said that the Gilded Ones is being turned into a film. That's pretty cool.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. I'm gonna have to read about that. I wonder if she's writing it. I wonder who's writing it. So that's cool. I guess Wings of Ebony Films coming. It's coming. Oh, cross your fingers. Well, massive congratulations for
thank you
for another turn on the New York Times bestseller. It's so great. That's so great.
Thank you.
So great to hear. And congratulations, and obviously well deserved. You know, this thing. One of the things I really liked about this book is, I mean, it clearly is there's more story to tell, but at the same time, it does feel, you know, complete in a lot of ways too. I mean, we could,
yeah.
But there is, you know, what's really going on here is just these, you know, these people's just putrid hatred of Black people. It's like, it's nihilistic in a way that's like in them. They can't even help it. It's so gross. And, you know, that's really affirming, I think, for Rue in a lot of ways, because she knows that, she understands that. And now that she's got this team with her and she's able to do something about it, and we find out that, you know, the main bad guy, the Chancellor, is still around and up to no good.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, you know, when you were writing this, was this just a long story that you chopped in half, or are you like, because it's like, I feel like you went pretty big. So it's, you know, if you tell me we're going bigger, that's great.
Well, there's a chancellor to take care of, right? Like, we can't, you know, there's multiple layers to this. And I think that's an important thing too. Like, you can't fix systemic racism by just changing the president. You know, you have to do lots of things. And so
that didn't happen. That didn't end on January 20th.
Nope.
Oh, geez. They keep saying it was going to. Yeah.
So I just feel like there's, you know, there's multiple steps that need to be taken. And I think too, there's layers here, without spoiling the sequel too much.
Yeah.
I
mean, don't say anything.
It's very clear at the end of book one, that what book two is going to be about. So that's not entirely spoiled. Like, Unity's going back to Kazan, you know, the chancellor marching on the mountain. So you have an idea of what's coming, but like there's sort of the enemy that's blatant, right? And then there's the enemy that, you know, maybe their motivations are a little different. Maybe in their mind, you know, what they did was right. Maybe they think they're helping the people. And I thought it was important that I address both villains, the overt racist and the quiet one. So book two.
I guess the only place left to end it on is Julius and Jamal.
What team are you?
I was an early out ride or die team Jamal. I am team Jamal from day one. I'm still team Jamal, and it's for a very like mechanical, non-emotional reason. I don't like second chance tropes.
Okay.
Second chance romance tropes, I should say.
All my romance writing friends are like, he lost her once. He doesn't deserve her again. All of them.
That's where I'm at. I'm like, you had your chance, you blew it. So for that, I am team Jamal. That beautiful brown god who just, you know.
Yes.
What did you say? He had legs like, thighs like drums. I was like, I had to fan myself. I was like, ooh. Are you? Yeah. I don't think you publicly stated. Well, are you allowed to? You won't, eh? There's no way you'll take a position. You can't. How could you?
I will say this.
Okay.
My editor and I are not on the same team,
which
is very, very healthy.
Okay.
For the book.
Right.
Because my goal, I will also tell you this. My goal with book two is to only make people more loyal to
you're gonna have some flip-floppers
sure. But you're also gonna have people say, you know, no, I stick with my opinion for one reason or another.
Sure.
You know, there aren't perfect characters, so
it sounds like they're both going to be in, we're going to see them more of them then.
The love triangle is a huge part of a book too.
Good.
Huge.
Yeah. I mean, I love people fighting over Rue. She deserves it.
That's great.
She
should have
the world fighting over her. There's no doubt about it. But
yes, she should. Literally. Go fight over it and buy the book.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I mean, listen, I'm a life is too short for bullshit type of person. So when I tell you something, I mean it. You know I love this book.
I appreciate that. I do.
We're going to keep shouting about it. Again, that's so great that you're on the list again for the second week in a row. Well-deserved. Go celebrate however you choose to.
doing homework with my children.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Yes, I need to do homework with my kids.
Hashtag writer's life, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, yeah. It. Well, that's good. I'm sure they appreciate it. Thank you for taking time away from your family to speak to me. I really appreciate it. If anyone doesn't know, I can't imagine Wings of Ebony is out now. Please buy it, preferably not from Pandemic Profiteers. We don't like to support him on this show. bookshop.org if you don't know a local indie place in your area. Any parting words?
I am just very, very grateful for the people who are giving Rue an opportunity to prick their heart. Anyone on the fence about reading the book, I dare you to read it and come away unchanged. It's impossible.
I agree. It is impossible. I also dare you to do it. And I can't. There's, at this rate, there's going to be nobody left to read it. Everyone will have read it. But you know, anyone out there that dares take up that challenge, and if they or find themselves in a position where they can't afford it, reach out to me and I will make sure you get a copy, whether it's electronic or hardcover.
That is so kind. Thank you, Steve.
All right, Jay, enjoy the rest of your night. Enjoy homework.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to JL for taking the time to chat with me today. It was a real treat for me personally, and I could not be happier for her and all of her success. And I was only half kidding, because this time next year, if you thought she was big now, just you wait. Wings of Ebony is, of course, out now, so please buy it wherever books are sold. You can actually head on over to wingsofebony.com to find the best way to do that and check out all the things JL has going on. Another reminder that we are in the middle of Black History Month, so be sure to support Black authors all month long and all year long by not only buying and reading books from Black authors, but by boosting their work however you can. It's all a huge help. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.